for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Congressman Henry Waxman of California knows that most people don't have a particularly favorable opinion of Congress. But he says that's because people don't understand what Congress really does. In a new book, he offers his ideas on how important legislation gets written and his perspective on the enormous legislative challenges ahead. His new book is titled The Waxman Report. Congressman Henry Waxman joins me in the studio to talk about his years in Congress, health care, climate change, and the art of making laws. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you,
Good
sir.
Morning.
Thanks for being here.
I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. Why do you think the American people have such a poor opinion of Congress?
I think there are two reasons. We've heard so much anti-government talk since President Reagan's time. Even President Reagan said in his inaugural speech, government is not the answer, government is the problem. So I think the public has been fed a steady diet of how government is not there to help, that government can't do anything good. That's the first problem.
Is that a political position?
I think it is. It is a political position by those people in the Republican Party that don't believe in government, don't want it. And during the Bush years, they appointed people to run agencies and starved them for funds with the objective of those people not doing a good job so they could say, see, government can't do a good job. The second thing is that the media focuses on scandals and the negative. But it's hard for people to realize that Congress and government can be an important force in the lives of millions of Americans. And behind the scenes, Congress is often doing things and getting things done that after a very difficult legislative fight, the accomplishment is almost taken for granted because people think that's just the way it should be. Let me give you an example. It was a very difficult fight to just simply put nutrition labeling on food. We all take it for granted. We go to the store. We want to watch the sodium, the calories, the carbohydrates, or whatever. The food producers said this would be such an incredible burden on them. They couldn't be profitable. They would be at a disadvantage with others. And yet we overcame that and passed the law, and people now take it for granted. Or even a better example, because some of us can remember the time when you went on an airline and they had smokers smoking on the airlines. They might have been in a separate section, but the smoke didn't know that there was a separate section. The Congress, or at least the House, passed an experiment by two or three votes to ban smoking on airlines of 2 hours or less just to see if it would work. And that only passed by the narrowest of margins. People argued that the smokers wouldn't tolerate it. There would be chaos on the planes. After 2 years, it was so popular, it would be barbaric to think now of going on an airplane and smelling somebody else's tobacco smoke.
You held a very important hearing on this very issue of smoking and tobacco and how lethal it is. Do you remember that?
I certainly do remember it. Of course, I held many hearings because as chairman of the Health and Environment Subcommittee, you can't ignore smoking, which is the leading preventable cause of death, 400,000 people each year. And after a number of hearings on the dangers of tobacco, we, in 1994, held a hearing with the chief executive officers of the seven tobacco companies. They came in, not by a subpoena, but voluntarily, because they wanted to put an end to the talk that they manipulated the nicotine to keep people addicted to smoking, and they wanted to clear the air, so to speak, from their point of view about the idea of environmental tobacco smoke harming non-smokers. So they came in, swore to tell the truth, and immediately lied. They lied about the dangers of cigarettes and how it causes lung cancer and heart disease and other illnesses. They lied about nicotine even being addictive. They lied about the manipulation of the nicotine, and they lied about the fact that they were trying to target kids 12 and 13 years of age to get them to smoke a particular brand so they could get customers for loyal customers for whatever shortened life that person might have.
And that hearing played over and over again with those four men standing there, arm raised to tell the truth.
Yeah.
Now, that was a hearing that somehow accomplished something.
Yes.
Very, very definitive and could be seen and understood by the public. But do you believe that there are so many hearings now on the Hill and so little accomplished that people have sort of tuned out?
I think that hearings and oversight is about as important a role for Congress, maybe even more than legislation. That particular hearing had an enormous impact. It was a turning point in this country for the image of the American public about the tobacco industry. They saw the face of the tobacco industry.
Right.
A bunch of middle-aged men in suits lying. And everybody knew they were lying. After that, the wall that kept us from knowing what goes on in the tobacco industry broke down, and we got the internal records, and we got insiders who came forward and told us the cynical things that they were doing, the most cynical of which, in my mind, was when the people who make Camel cigarettes, which was primarily used by very few farmers, middle-aged men, someplace or other, decided they wanted to hype that brand for kids in order to compete with Philip Morris. So they started a campaign in France to see if Joe Camel ads could get kids to smoke. And we had the discussions in the boardroom talking about how if they could only get 14-year-olds to start smoking Camels, how they can be competitive. It was just money and cynicism about matters of life and death.
I have talked many times to former FDA Commissioner Kessler,
yes,
who has said that if you can get somebody hooked before they're 19, you got them for life. So I understand that effort on the part of the tobacco companies. But you know, Congressman Waxman, I remember when that first announcement of the deadly effects of tobacco came out in 1964. Why did it take until 1994 to get to the bottom of that?
The tobacco industry spent millions of dollars. When that first information came out about the harm, the lung cancer connection, they said they are not going to allow that to happen. They're going to set up an institute, a tobacco institute, to do studies to see if their product really harms people. What they funded instead was a multi-decades long deception propaganda campaign. When we used to hold hearings, they always insisted on having one of their pseudoscientists come in and try to keep open the question of whether cigarettes really were the cause of harm. Maybe it was simply a coincidence. Of course, that propaganda allowed smokers to feel, well, maybe it's not clear I can continue smoking. They were the most powerful lobbying force in Washington for a long period of time. They and the pharmaceutical companies were the one and two leading contributors by far above anybody else of the Republican Party. And I used to say, I can understand why they'd want to buy the Republican Party, but I didn't know why the Republican Party would want to sell themselves to tobacco, but they did for a long period of time.
Congressman Henry Waxman, Democrat of California. His new book is titled The Waxman Report, How Congress Really Works. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Healthcare is...
Before I get to that, I said Republican Party. I should say the Republican leadership, because we just passed, finally, after all these years, a bill to give FDA jurisdiction to regulate tobacco. It was a strong bipartisan vote. But the Republican leadership under Newt Gingrich and Tom DeLay were controlled by the tobacco industry. In fact, Tom DeLay, when he flew to Texas to plead not guilty for a criminal offense, flew in RJR Tobacco's jet. they were so cozy with the tobacco industry. But I don't think that reflects the views of, I know it doesn't reflect the views of the Republicans who voted with us on the tobacco bill. Finally, last week or the week before, the president signed into law legislation to regulate tobacco. But I think that hearing we had in 1994 was the real turning point. And we made a lot of progress simply by making people understand and drawing the attention to the issue.
Now,
healthcare
is really on the minds of people. Where is it going to go, Congressman?
I feel confident we're going to get a healthcare bill this year. President Obama campaigned on reforming our healthcare system, trying to make sure that every American has an affordable, good quality healthcare insurance package. He has a mandate to do it. Unlike President Bush, when he came after his reelection and said, I've got a mandate to change Social Security, and nobody ever heard about it in the campaign. President Obama campaigned on it. He wants to get this done, and I'm doing everything I can to help him. We're going to get it done.
Now, what I hear first and foremost is that people ask, why is a single-payer plan, a government-sponsored single-payer plan, off the table?
The attempt to get health care reform is complex and controversial, not with people, but with a lot of the interest groups, and they're able to twist people's view of what's going on. So President Obama rightfully said, I want to make my proposal moderate and not look extreme and scare people. Single payer would scare a lot of people, and it probably politically wouldn't be sustainable. Same with other ideas that are also extreme, like the Wyden-Bennett proposal. So he's working to get the middle together for health care reform.
Congressman Henry Waxman, short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Congressman Henry Waxman of California is with me. We are talking, as you can well imagine, about many, many issues. His new book is titled The Waxman Report, How Congress Really Works. We were talking just before the break about health care, and here are a pile of emails on that very subject. Polls show 70% of the public favors a single-payer health care program, yet Congress says everything is on the table except single-payer. One, how can we have any respect for Congress when it so blatantly ignores the will of the people? And two, if Congress isn't listening to the public on this issue, to whom are they listening?
When President Obama campaigned, he said he wanted to reform health care, make sure everybody had health insurance, and we hold down the costs. But he was very careful to say that he wanted to do it in a way that would ease people's anxieties. So he said, if you have health insurance you like, you get to keep it, which means people have health insurance at their jobs and they're satisfied with it. If you're on Medicare, don't worry about it. We're going to leave Medicare alone. What he wanted to do was to provide an opportunity for people who don't have health insurance, which are mainly working people, now a lot of unemployed people, but working people whose employers can't afford to provide health insurance. they would go to an exchange and choose among a different group of plans, private insurance plan and one public insurance plan. They wouldn't be forced into anything. It would be their choice. The reason he wanted a public plan, and why I think it's important to have a public plan available as an option, is it will keep everybody honest. For example, in the Medicare Part D, the Republicans wrote it so that you go out and buy an insurance policy for pharmaceuticals if you're under Medicare. Well, we have no idea what kind of rebates those insurance companies get from the pharmaceutical manufacturers. We see no evidence they're really passing it on to the consumers. There's no transparency. There's no real accountability. There's no real competition. They said there was going to be competition. There's really not competition. So to provide some real competition, a public plan people could rely on and know they can count on would be an option. But many people, maybe most, wouldn't choose it. But it keeps the whole system honest.
Who's campaigning against it?
Well, the main group against the public plan is the private insurance companies. They don't want it. They don't want competition. Now, when you realize that most insurance companies for individual policies have spent their money trying to exclude covering people who may get sick, they are very, very sophisticated on how not to cover people. Now, they say they're going to be willing to accept requirements that they can't exclude people for pre-existing conditions or charge people more because of age or other criteria. They say that, and we'll put it into law. But there are a lot of sophisticated ways that the insurance companies have learned to exclude people. In fact, I remember the story of how a managed care plan would ask people to walk two flights of stairs to come in and sign up, knowing that if somebody couldn't handle that, they would be eligible for the insurance, but they wouldn't get it, and it could weed out some of those people that are higher risk.
What's the difference in your mind between public insurance and co-ops?
I don't understand the co-op idea.
I don't either.
It sounds to me, well, it is rather gimmicky to try to bridge a political difference in the Senate. If the Senate adopts the co-op, we'll look at it when we get into conference. I feel that the House will adopt a public plan as an option. And in fact, I don't think a bill can pass the House of Representatives without a public plan.
And would that public plan have a separate government office to regulate it?
It would be run by the government, but we're trying to design it as in a way that it will not win the competition, but be on a level playing field with other insurance policies.
Would that mean it would cost as much as other insurance policies?
It may, but probably wouldn't. Insurance companies have high overhead for their executives and their bureaucracies, although they won't need as much money if they're not trying to work to exclude people. But the different people have different reasons for choosing insurance. Some like a managed care or health maintenance organization. Some like something like a fee-for-service or a PPO, preferred provider organization. I think a public plan has an opportunity to be a lot more experimental in organizing the healthcare delivery system in ways that can be a model for the private insurance plans to figure out how to make sure we don't provide excessive care, which is very costly and unnecessary.
Here's an email from Russ in Princeton, New Jersey. Which would you ultimately prefer? Healthcare legislation that passes with bipartisan support but without a government health insurance option, or healthcare legislation that passes with minimum Republican support but with a government health insurance option?
My first choice would be to have a good bill with bipartisan support. But we can only control that so much, because it appears that the Republican Party leadership in the Congress has made a decision that they want to try to deny President Obama success, which means, in my mind, they're rooting against the country as well. So they voted against the stimulus bill, even though even conservative economists said it was necessary to get jobs because the private sector wasn't making investments and we needed the public investments. They voted against the stimulus bill. For the most part, they voted against the global warming energy bill, although we had some eight Republicans or so. I think in the House, we're going to get very few. We'll get some Republicans. But to me, I'd like bipartisanship. We've tried to be bipartisan. I even went over to the Republican side of the committee to encourage them to join with us on the global warming bill. But the ranking Republican, Joe Barton, said he didn't believe in the science. He didn't believe there was such a thing as global warming, so he didn't see a reason for a solution. And the other Republicans did not want to get involved and engage in that issue. But somewhere along the line, one Republican leader told me, when it comes out of conference, he thinks some Republicans will vote for it, maybe a lot of them. One, because they think it's going to be a weaker bill, but two, they don't want to go home to the voters on something as important as health care and have the record of voting no.
Here's a final question on health care from Facebook. Amber asks why the public option for health insurance is so threatening to the current private insurance industry. Having a nonprofit government insurance plan would offer greater competition and choice for Americans. Will the public option survive the legislative battles intact?
I think it will survive, and I'm going to do all I can to make sure it survives. But I think the private insurance companies feel that it's a competition they may not succeed well in, and they'd rather not have competition, I suppose. That speaks for every industry that has to fight for business. I think they're being short-sighted. If it were a public option that completely underpaid, like Medicare, it could negotiate. It could set the prices, and the private insurance companies feel that they would have to pay a higher price. They wouldn't be able to compete. Well, I think that's a reasonable argument, and we have to come to terms with it. But I don't think eliminating competition is the solution the way the private insurance companies do.
How much money will the insurance companies spend to try to defeat a public option?
Oh, I don't know how much they're going to spend, but there's going to be a lot of money spent in this whole effort on health care by a lot of different forces. In fact, I remember someone making the case that when President Clinton proposed health care reform, more money was spent in lobbying on that plan, both for and against, than was spent on the presidential campaign that brought Clinton to office. So an incredible amount of money. You see that, remember the television commercials, but the real costs are also the lobbying and the mobilization efforts around the country to convince people that that they're going to lose something. One of the fears that we have is that people will think they're going to lose what they have, and they're going to have to pay more money for somebody else. And while most Americans are pretty magnanimous, this one strikes home, particularly at a time of economic difficulties.
You know, there are an awful lot of people who support the idea that the Republican congressman said when you went across the aisle about global warming. He said he didn't believe that there was any such thing. How much of that do you encounter on the Hill?
Some, but I would say that most people, since there's such an overwhelming scientific consensus on the issue, realize that there's a problem, but they don't want to come to terms with it. They worry about the economic consequences, especially on a regional basis. This is in reality more a regional issue than a partisan one, although the public would think it was a partisan issue alone. We tried in that energy global warming bill to bridge the regional differences and to bring together a coalition of industry and environmentalists. We had the opportunity to work off a report by the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, U.S. CAP, and that was made up of CEOs of some of the major industries along with the environmental groups. They reached a consensus. We worked off that consensus. And when our bill was in committee, to a lot of people's amazement, we had support from the utilities, some of the major industries, the automobile industry, a lot of others on the industrial side, many of whom just wanted the rules to be settled so they can make their investments. They know that something's coming sometime, and they don't want to make investments and find that they can't stay with those investments. and, of course, the environmental groups who wanted the reduction in carbon emissions that do so much harm to our planet, and all of us who want more jobs, and there are going to be millions of jobs. It's going to transform our economy in a new direction with new jobs.
But how do you counter conservative columnists, analysts, talk show hosts who claim that they have as many scientists on their side saying there is no such thing as global warming? How do you deal with that kind of conviction on their side that is convincing a lot of people?
I think it's reminiscent of the tobacco industry scientists. You can always find somebody who has a scientific degree who will raise uncertainty about the science. I don't think anybody on their side, well, maybe a few, absolutely deny it. They think perhaps global warming is happening, but it's not due to man-made pollution. Maybe it's due to natural causes. You can't deny global warming, as people have, because it's objectively verifiable. But for the longest time, it was denied. And the Bush administration spent 8 years suppressing their own scientists who wanted to talk about their findings of damage to the environment because of carbon emissions.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Congressman Waxman, you've been in the Congress for most of your life. Tell us a little about your background.
I've always been interested in politics, and my family were ardent Democrats because of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. They had a deep conviction, which they've shared and inculcated in me, that government can play an important role in a very positive way in the lives of millions of people. They saw it when Franklin Roosevelt looked after people during the Great Depression and mobilized the nation for war when a lot of people were isolationist before World War II. I grew up as the first member of my family to go to college. I went to public schools. I went to the University of California. I had these opportunities. My family had health care coverage because my father was a member of the Retail Clerks Union. He was a grocery clerk. And we had health care so that we didn't have to worry about these things. We were in the middle class with the opportunity to move forward. And many of these opportunities were because the American people recognize that through government, we can give every American an opportunity to live up to their fullest potential. And we also believe that if people didn't have much potential, you didn't let them fall to the very bottom, you had to have a safety net, just recognizing the human dignity of individuals. So that's been a lodestone of my political views. I have a strong feeling that we got to try to make this a better world, and government can play an important role in doing that.
Now, most recently, people have seen on television, read in newspapers, heard on radio reports about the behavior of some politicians that is less than desirable. I'm certainly thinking about John Edwards. I'm thinking about John Ensign, Mark Sanford. I'd like your view on what it is that happens to men, particularly when they reach this level of superiority and power in politics. What is it that happens that makes them go astray?
I don't think it's unique to politicians, but I do think that people always have to watch themselves because power corrupts. And you always have to watch that you're not rationalizing behavior that is not of the highest ethical standards. I say this as a generalization. Of course, people point to the politicians and they used to say, those are government people, you can't trust them. But look at private enterprise. There you have great success stories. Well, I say that now sarcastically because for the longest time, the philosophy of government under the Bush administration was government could do no good, but the private sector could do no wrong. So we contracted out to private enterprise all sorts of activities and wasted billions of dollars because they were willing to take advantage of the situation. We held hearings on Halliburton in Iraq. contracting to deal with Hurricane Katrina, all the ways that we had contracts given without competition and cost-plus contracts, which encouraged even more costs. A story that comes to my mind is when we had Hurricane Katrina, we hired a big contractor, who hired a subcontractor, who hired another subcontractor. Each one took a piece of the pie and then hired a guy with a truck to remove debris. Well, why didn't we just hire the guy with the truck? But the reason we didn't is that we thought the private sector can do no wrong, and we didn't even have government people to watch out to protect the taxpayers, and that from people who call themselves fiscal conservatives.
Congressman Henry Waxman, and we'll take just a short break now. When we come back, your calls, your questions, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. And don't forget, you can reach us on Facebook and Twitter.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Island Press and the Tides Foundation. Island Press provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mother-in-law jokes have been a mainstay of comedy for centuries, but real-life problems with in-laws are seldom laughing matters. A psychologist offers advice on how to get along. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And it's time now to open the phones. Your questions, comments for California Congressman, Democrat Henry Waxman. His new book is titled The Waxman Report, How Congress Really Works. He's talked about the efforts at bipartisanship. He's talked about hearings on tobacco. He's talked about global warming and what the Congress is trying to do regarding that issue as well. Let's go first to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. I worked in hospital management for 15 years, so I know a little bit about the healthcare subject, and I support the public option. My problem is with the rhetoric of the debate. Can the congressman tell me why the Democrats don't take this line of response to the Republicans? We have public hospitals, we have public clinics, we have public transportation, we have public education, we have public libraries, we have public broadcasting. Nobody calls that socialized transportation or socialized education, and the public hospitals certainly don't put the private hospitals out of business. Why do they not use that response to the socialized medicine argument that's really vacuous and senseless?
You make an excellent point, absolutely, and I'm going to emphasize that argument, because the Republicans say if you call anything public, it's socialism.
Right.
Well, that's absurd. I remember, just as an aside, when President Bush vetoed the child health insurance bill, he made, and it was a bipartisan supported bill to fund to the states money to help low-income children who weren't below the poverty line, but poor nevertheless and didn't have health insurance. He argued, why should the government subsidize kids for health insurance if their parents may be able to buy a private insurance policy? Well, first of all, maybe they weren't able to buy a private insurance policy, but if you think of that argument relating to schools, could you imagine a politician saying, why should we subsidize public education for children whose parents can't afford to send them to private schools? Mm. It reflects an ideology, and it's a dangerous one because it rejects the fact that we have obligations, public obligations, to serve people, not just leave it to the private sector for those who can afford it.
John, I'm glad you called. Thanks a lot. Congressman, you've written this book called, subtitled, How Congress Really Works. And here's an email from Sarah who says, if 70% of the American people favor a single-payer system, why isn't Congress listening? And who are they listening to? In addition, to whom is Mr. Obama listening? Doesn't look as though they're listening to the American people. How could 70% of the American people help the Congress to realize that that's what they want? They want a single-payer system, and help the Congress stand up against the insurance lobbyists.
Polls reflect a point of view at any particular time, but arguments can be brought to bear that could change those poll results. For example, to get to a single-payer system, we'd have to take everybody off the insurance that they now have and give them a different policy. We'd have to pay for it by raising all sorts of taxes that would, of course, put the Democrats as a target for raising huge amounts of taxes because, in effect, we're taking money we're spending on the private side and now spending it on the public side. People like variations of their health care services, so we'd have to move to that as quickly as we can because people would say, oh, I don't want a one-size-fits-all, and I want some variation, and I want to see my own doctor, and I want this, and I want that, legitimately. So it is, by nature, radical, given the circumstances in which we live. If we were starting from scratch, that would make a lot of sense. Mm. There's a bill, Senator Wyden and Bennett, that would give people the opportunity to buy private plans through changes in the tax code. They have a lot to say for these ideas, except they are too dramatic and too radical, and I don't think when you get into it, the interest groups would, I think they'd be able to pick on it so that 70% would be less than a majority and less than enough to pass the Congress.
And that's what your book is all about, is it not? That is how the Congress goes about making laws.
It's very important for people to understand that compromise is not a bad word if you're getting the objectives you want. For example, on the energy global warming bill, we made a lot of compromises in the transition to lower carbon emissions to make sure that there wasn't any abrupt change that would harm different segments of our population regionally or different industries. We did that because it would bring stronger support and eliminate some of the opposition. That's not unique to that bill. Congress has to recognize that there are differing opinions, there are differing interests, and we have to, as best we can, reconcile them, keeping in mind you can't compromise always by splitting the difference. You've got to make sure that you accomplish what you set out to accomplish.
Do the moneyed interests in this country now have as much power as does the Congress?
Well, the moneyed interests have an inordinate amount of power, and it's a problem. But I think that it's not always so clear-cut that you have the moneyed special interests on one side and the public interest on the other. Sometimes you have one interest group against another interest group. Sometimes the public interest is and every one of these special interests believes that the public interest is aligned with themselves. They rationalize their position, and sometimes they're partly right, sometimes they're wrong. That's why Congress needs to do the job of oversight and hearings and challenging the statements that are made. Often in my book, I talk about how we were completely outspent by moneyed interest in the legislative battles, but eventually they can't sustain something that is so untrue when you scrutinize it and challenge it. For example, when we were doing the Clean Air Act, we were told that we couldn't do anything about acid rain, which came from coal-burning power plants in the Midwest that spewed the sulfur into the Northeast and came down and poisoned the lakes and the streams and the forests. They said it would cost so many billions of dollars a ton for reductions, it would drive them out of business. Well, they made that case. They argued it over and over again. It just wasn't credible. And when we enacted the law, which was a cap-and-trade system, we said, you go out and achieve those reductions as inexpensively as possible, but you have to do it. And they achieved the reductions. Acid rain is not a problem any longer, at a tenth of what the industry was saying it would cost. The same with the auto industry. They always fought any changes. And then when we imposed it upon them, they went ahead and made the changes faster than we ever expected at a lower cost.
I think about the argument against seat belts. I think about the arguments against airbags and how the auto industry fought those. Let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning, Representative Waxman. I want to thank you for writing a good draft of the Clean Energy Bill. And I want folks to understand how important it is to make sure that the coal industry's amendment in the House bill, which revokes the presidential authority to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act, does not get into the Senate bill and thus into law. Please tell us what the effects of this amendment would be and how an amendment counter to the spirit of the bill can get put into a good bill and nullify the original good intentions, and what we can do in the future to prevent such poison pill amendments from making it into bills.
Thanks for calling.
The one of the driving forces to get legislation through is that the Supreme Court, on a 5-4 decision, said that the EPA must regulate if they find carbon to be a pollution, and they would have to regulate under the terms of the Clean Air Act. That is scaring the bejesus out of a lot of industries, appropriately, because under the Clean Air Act, the way EPA would have to regulate is pretty heavy-handed. It was never thought of in terms of carbon emissions. We were thinking of other kinds of localized pollutants. It can be done, and if we don't pass a bill, it will be done. But we wanted to legislate a different way of doing it, and in doing our legislation, we were replacing the ability of the EPA to regulate under the Clean Air Act with the regulations under the law we were proposing. It wasn't a coal industry amendment that you're expressing concern about. It was really what we proposed to do, because we said, let's do the regulations, the cap and trade, the incentives to reduce carbon emissions, the investment in technology to be able to use coal at some point in an environmentally friendly way sometime, so that we don't have to discard what is a domestic resource and which is being used all over the world. So the technology will be helpful for us, not just here at home, but exported elsewhere. So I think there's some misunderstanding that repealing the EPA regulation under Clean Air Act was not a step backwards. It was a replaced by the global warming bill that we adopted.
Do you remain concerned that the industry can somehow slip out of some of that regulation?
I think that it's important to insist that the carbon reductions must be achieved in the timetable that we set out in the legislation, And if we do that, we will achieve what the scientists tell us we must do to avert what may be tipping points in global warming that could cause irreversible damage. I want to follow the science and get there to what they think we need to achieve in, by way of reductions.
Let's go to Terry in Indianapolis. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
Mr. Waxman, I follow politics, and I'm an interest in both sides of all issues to try to get the best information. One of the things I get challenged by is earlier you were talking about the global warming aspect and how people on the other side don't understand, and you can always get a scientist to express their views against an issue and stuff. I don't believe there's been a firm dialogue about global warming. I feel people of your ilk and bourgeois mentality sit there and say, well, it's global warming's happening, and other people are kind of, you know, not realizing into it yet. Certainly, you can sit there and say, just like cigarettes, yeah, pollution is not good. That's ABC common sense. But to be spending billions and billions of dollars in times of, you know, recession and other things should get attention to it is just way too arrogant, especially since you haven't, I feel, give a good discourse to a good dialogue. I mean, Al Gore was allowed to go on the Hill unreputed and speak his vitriol on the topic and yet never countered. So if you can enlighten me where I'm wrong, and I'll take my answer off the phone.
All right, and thanks for your call, Terry. At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Congressman, your bourgeois mentality.
I think we've had plenty of opportunity for all sides to be heard on the science of global warming, and I'm open to further commentary so that we never stop investigating and learning. But let me pose this. Even if the scientists who are very worried about global warming are wrong, it is important for our country to become less dependent on foreign oil. It's a national security imperative. Every time the Saudis want to keep us addicted, they either raise or lower the prices for oil. We are importing more oil now than we did when the oil crisis in the 70s occurred. We consume 25% of the world's oil, and we produce 8%. Well, the increase of burning more oil is adding to the environmental damage, and it's a threat to our national security. So let's recognize that even if you're not buying the whole global warming concept, it's worthwhile producing more jobs. It's worthwhile making us more independent as a nation for controlling our own destiny. And I think reductions in carbon emissions is going to do some good. And by the time we get to the major reductions down the road, we'll have even more information on the science. We can make adjustments.
All right, Tan. Quick question here from Rob, who says, we are a small family-run importer and manufacturer of natural toys made from organic cotton and other natural materials. We pride the fact that our manufactured products are made here in the USA. However, the CPSIA, Consumer Product Safety
Commission,
is forcing us to cut our product line in half this year, and most products will be gone by this time next year, and maybe we will too. We could survive if we move our production to China and produce in huge lots. We don't want to do that. Why are we in this situation? Why do you refuse to have hearings on this very important subject?
I think you make a good argument. I know you're concerned, as are others, about the enforcement of the Consumer Product Safety Act. I don't agree with the idea that you're going to escape the law by producing toys in China. Most toys sold in the United States are made in China. But that law wanted to protect infants from toys that are made with chemicals that can do them neurological damage. But the people running the Consumer Product Safety Commission are enforcing it in a way that, to me, doesn't make sense. And we're hoping with the new people taking control of the agency, we'll have a more thoughtful regulation and enforcement. And if not, we're going to have to legislate.
And are you planning to hold hearings?
We will be holding hearings and looking at this issue and trying to deal with it.
And one last question. Is the U.S. government still subsidizing the growth of tobacco?
The U.S. government is not subsidizing directly the growth of tobacco, but there are other farm programs that keep those farmers making their profits.
Whoa, that's a toughie.
Yes.
That's a toughie. Congressman Henry Waxman, his new book is titled The Waxman Report. We should have allowed for at least 2 hours. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Good
Thank
to
you.
Talk with you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.